questions, real answers, real firefighters.
All right, welcome to RadioFirehouse.com. I'm Bob Duma, your host for The Buzz on Technical Rescue. Today's show, we'll be talking about elevator emergencies and some of the different specialty aspects that a company may have to be knowledgeable of when they respond to one of these calls. My guest today is Tony Tricarico, a retired captain out of the Fire Department of New York. Tony's last assignment was on Squad 252. Also, during his years, he's worked as an instructor at the FDNY Rescue School and also an instructor in Suffolk County. Tony, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob.
Kind of getting into the background on elevator rescue and in emergency situations, maybe a little bit of history on elevators themselves. One of the things maybe we'll throw in once in a while is a couple tricks of the trade to help our listeners take something back to their fire station with them that might help them when they go to a type of call that you've had the background of going into. Elevators in general, just a kind of a quick overview, just a little bit of history on them. They're everywhere nowadays. The Americans with Disabilities Act has put them into structures we never thought we'd ever seen them in. So even small town America has elevators. It isn't only New York City, Chicago, the large metropolitan areas. So we'll start out with that. How about some history?
Okay. Basically, elevators have been around since the Middle Ages. They would take a basket and a rope and use a couple of donkeys or have some guys on a wheel and just pull things up and down, usually to move maybe a disabled person or an older feeble person or move goods up and down to get the product to where they have to. And as things evolved, the evolution, the industrial evolution, they started using electricity and they started doing, having sheaves and started using hydraulics and steam. Elisha Otis, he developed the first safety systems. He was actually at the New York Palace and on a platform cut a rope and everybody gasped as his platform started to fall, but the platform was captured by his safety device. And he touted how people were getting killed all the time in those days. They were using manila ropes to hoist elevators. And Otis was the guy who developed these safety devices, and he just created the safety factor that people were looking for. Then with the advent of electricity and steel, and they started building skyscrapers, and the safety devices kept developing more and more, and everybody knows we have 100-story skyscrapers with elevators that shoot right up there, and we really don't have elevators plummeting to the bottom.
And good point you hit on already is when Otis came up with his innovation for the elevator industry, safety was the big thing. From the fire service, safety's always important to us. When you train your people and when you respond, what are some of the things you're looking at as a company officer or as a first-in firefighter in the area of safety to make sure we come home safe and sound?
Well, that's always our priority, make sure everybody, all of our people go home. As far as safety goes, Shutting the elevator power is probably the number one safety aspect you can do, because shutting the elevator power keeps anything from moving on the elevator most of the time. You can't be 100% all the time because things just go wrong. Could be a wire rope breaks or the safety doesn't catch right away. And a movement of an elevator just a few inches in either direction can sever a limb right off of a person.
Okay, and with this, the elevators themselves, you talked about the early onset. It was nothing but a basket with a rope over a structure and a heavy weight on the other end. They've definitely evolved in the way they're built. Why don't you share a little with us on just the structure or the design? What is an elevator made up of?
Okay, basically an elevator is a really simple device. It's a box on a rope. And it's how you move this box up and down that makes a difference. Now, so that's where we come in with counterbalance weights. The counterbalance weights offset the amount of energy needed to move this elevator up and down on a rope, what they call a roped elevator. Even though we use the terms roped, it's a steel cable. So these steel cables move the elevator up and down, and the counterbalance weight creates a potential energy to keep this thing moving with the minimum amount of energy necessary to get it to propel.
Okay. With that, you have your cable or rope style elevators, and now I see in a lot of smaller buildings now elevators that are run off of a hydraulic type of system. How do they vary?
Well, as you said earlier, with the American with Disabilities Act, We have any building built two stories or more since the 80s is required to have an elevator in it. So the hydraulic elevators are simple enough to put in. They don't have to do a tremendous amount of work to get it. And this is what Middle America is going to see mostly, is hydraulic elevators. Really, really simple machine. It's a pump pushing fluid into a cylinder that drives a piston up. And then when it gets to its point, the electronics level it and get it to the point where people can go in and out. And then when it needs to come down, it's a valve that opens, and the pressure, the weight of the elevator creates the pressure to drive the fluid back into the main reservoir.
Okay. Now, because we're working off of a cylinder, is height an issue with our hydraulic elevators compared to the cable style?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The higher you go, the deeper the cylinder has to go into the ground. So if you got a 10-story building, the cylinder has to go 9 stories into the ground. That's where roped elevators become more practical. But with the smaller buildings, the hydraulic system works just fine.
Okay, so basically it's a niche market. Certain application, it'll fit. Others, you kind of adapt to the structure you are working on. With these, obviously everything has pros and cons. Assuming from our conversation, hydraulic, obviously height is going to be one of the negatives. What are some of the benefits of going with a hydraulic system?
The benefit of the hydraulic system is on the small buildings. They're simple to work on. It's a basic pressurized system. They're easy to capture. They're easy for us to work on also as firefighters coming into it, because it's a basic pressurized system. So it's not a difficult thing. When you start to get into the higher stories, the rope systems are more practical, because it just takes too much energy to drive a hydraulic elevator up 6, 7, 8 stories.
Okay, and with our rope systems, I know from responding to different elevator emergencies throughout my career, one of the first things that we're directed to is looking for the counterbalance. Kind of explain to our listeners what the counterbalance is and how it affects the elevator, and by finding it, what does it tell us in the emergency rescue services about the elevator's position?
Okay, a counterbalance weight offsets the weight of the elevator. It usually weighs in at the total weight of the elevator plus 40% of its capacity. That's how much a counterbalance weight is supposed to be weighing it at. So this gives us the potential energy to keep the elevator moving up and down. If I were to open a hoistway door on the first floor and see the elevator counterbalance weight in front of me, that would indicate to me that the elevator is in the opposite position on the top floor, and vice versa. If my elevator is on the first floor, the counterbalance weight is on the top floor. That's where we get the potential energy created. So this way it makes it easier to move the elevator up and down.
Okay, it makes sense. And there again, gaining access, and a little bit we'll talk about how to get into the elevators. We'll talk a little bit on the rescue component of it. Prior to getting into how to do the rescues, you know, we talked a little bit about safety. The elevator itself has various safety systems in it. What would be some of the built-in systems for the elevator itself to provide both safety to the elevator's operational capacity daily and us as rescuers when we go?
Okay, in today's elevators, there's a lot of safeties built in. Excuse me. In today's elevators, there's a lot of safeties built in. They have shoes that actually grab onto the guide rails that control the elevator or keep the elevator from swaying in the shaft. Those shoes are just like a brake system that would work on a disc brake system on a car. They capture an elevator if it exceeds the rated speed. If an elevator is supposed to be maximum speed is supposed to be 100 feet per second, and it goes up to 125 feet per second, these shoes will activate. They have governors on there. The governor ropes will also activate the brake shoes. They have flywheels that work off of a high tension spring. Once the elevator starts to exceed its speed, these flywheels will go out, having hooks capture the sheave so the elevator will no longer turn. They have interlock systems on the doors. Every door in and out of an elevator, including the top hatch and the side hatch, have interlock systems. If the interlock system is not closed, the elevator will not move. So there's a lot of redundancy in the safety of elevators today.
And it seems to be working, because I see over a period of time our frequency of responding to elevators, not for the malfunction mechanically, but the actual true emergency, seem to be getting fewer and fewer over the years.
That's true. It used to be back in the days when Otis was an active man in the mid-1800s to the late 1800s, there was a lot of elevators that just plummeted to the floor because they were using manila rope, and the ropes would wear out and the elevator would just fall. So people were actually very leery about it. Someone like my grandfather might have turned around and said, I'm not going in an elevator. I'll walk the 4 flights or 5 flights. Whereas once Graves, it's Elijah Graves' Otis. Once Otis created these safeties, people were getting more assured of using elevators. So they were able to use them more, and the death rate went down with the elevators. People were not walking into open shafts because the interlock system is working. With the advent of electricity and push buttons, you didn't need elevator operators anymore. The elevator operators would bring the elevator up and down and level the elevator out. So they created elevator levelers so that the elevator would know mechanically when it was equal to the hallway and you wouldn't have to step up or over to get into the hallway. So there's a lot of systems now that are creating safety.
Another one that I've read about, heard others talk about, is like electromagnetic brakes. How do they function within the elevator, and what are they providing us as far as safety and things a firefighter should know when they're responding?
Well, an electromagnetic brake works on the sheave wheel itself. The electromagnetic brake, when the power is on, is in the open position. So anytime power is disabled to that elevator, these electromagnetic brakes are no longer being held open, and they clamp down on the wheel so it can no longer turn, stopping the elevator.
Kind of
so
like
if you shut the power to an elevator, the electromagnetic brakes are automatically capturing that elevator in place.
Kind of like a safety brake on a vehicle. It's compressed until mechanically, or in this case with the electrical power, release. So it's giving it a positive contact.
Yes.
You mentioned going to the power room and the mechanical locations where these elevators are run. Between a hydraulic and a rope-style elevator, will we find these control centers in different locations in the facility?
Yes, absolutely. On a hydraulic elevator, we'll usually find it at the lowest floor, on the first floor of the basement. That's where the control mechanisms are for a hydraulic elevator because it's pushing it up. On a roped elevator, you will usually find it at the top of the shaft or two floors above the highest floor that the elevator serves. It's rare that you'll find a roped elevator mechanical room on the lower floors, but it does happen.
Like everything, there's always going to be that exception to the rule.
That's right.
With this, getting to these mechanical rooms, I would understand that they're going to handle and house very critical pieces of equipment for security purposes, vandalism, things of that nature. We're bringing almost another avenue of the rescue service in is forced entry. Is it difficult sometimes getting to these locations? We don't have the luxury of a key.
Sometimes it could be extremely difficult. I've encountered elevator machinery rooms that had diamond plate, like maybe quarter inch thick or heavier diamond plate walls built with doors on them. And then when you get through there, you had to get through a regular steel buck door. And then when you got through there, you had to ascend a ladder and get through another door before you can get into the machinery room. People don't want you playing with their elevators.
Which definitely makes sense. So we start to look at it's a knowledge-based rescue. It's an equipment-laden rescue because you have to prepare for different things. And it's very manpower intense. If we're going to have enough individuals to carry on the various tasks that we've already talked about and the additional things we'll talk about shortly when we get into rescues and actual functional capacity, a small department responding that now has a elevator in their community, in the town hall, in the local school that never had one, this could open up another avenue of need on their part for, you know, what they need to respond to the call with, correct?
Absolutely. An elevator emergency, well, there's elevator emergencies, there's elevator incidents. An elevator incident is usually somebody stuck in an elevator.
I'm sorry.
There's elevator emergencies and there's elevator incidents. An elevator incident is somebody stuck in an elevator and it's not of dire need to get them out. An elevator emergency, on the other hand, is we need to get these people out due to panic or injury or some other reason that we have to get these people out in a hurry. Knowing how to use the keys, knowing how the machinery works, knowing what your capabilities are and what your capabilities aren't are really important in this. Now, you have, in any small-town fire department where you have just two guys on an apparatus or three guys on an apparatus, that might not be enough for you to actually affect this rescue. You may have to call additional equipment in just so you have enough people to run this extrication.
With that, you're talking about, you know, emergency versus incidents. Rough numbers or stuff from your past research, about how many calls do the fire service respond to annually or over any period of time for elevator type of incidents or emergencies?
Well, I couldn't tell you exactly how many calls, but I can tell you that there's probably over 600,000 elevators in the United States, well over 600,000, giving us probably over 12,000 elevators per state, making, I think the numbers are high, like 12 million rides a year. And 10,000 people a year visit emergency rooms because of injuries incurred somehow with an elevator incident.
So when we're looking at percentages and, you know, Murphy's Law, something is eventually going to happen.
Eventually, we're all human.
When you're taking that many rides on an elevator across the nation or the world, because they're in every country you go to, something is eventually going to break, malfunction or human error. Sometimes an individual does something outside of, you know, the normal thought process per se. When you get on scene, size up. What would be you as a company officer coming into the incident? What would be some of the things you would do on your arrival to help mitigate the situation safely?
Well, the first thing we need to do is locate the elevator. So you can locate the elevator in many ways. Just looking at the elevator control panel in the lobby, you can open up the hoistway door and call up, looking for the counterbalance weight. If you have a commercial dwelling, like a Class C type dwelling in New York, they have a fire safety director's table there. They have phones that you can call into the elevator. So the first basic thing in size up is locate where the elevator is. Once you find the elevator and you go to it, you find out what the emergency is, whether it's an emergency or an incident. That'll determine the effort that you put forth in getting them out. In an incident, you can take your time and you can finesse your way in there. In an emergency, you may have to force entry. So that's just the initial size up. And of course, if we are going to work there, you'd want to try and get somebody up into the mechanical room and shut the power down.
Okay. Once we've gotten into that area or taken it, say, to a fire-related situation, we also utilize elevators at various types of responses outside of the actual elevator having problems itself. Two of the terms you hear used quite often are phase one and phase two. For someone who isn't familiar or comes from a part of the country where elevators aren't prominent, kind of give us a little background on that and just what a phase one and what a phase two elevator service would be to a firefighter or to anyone in general.
Okay, well, I'll kind of summarize it. Phase one, you stick the key into the fireman's service, you turn it on, and all the elevators will be recalled to the lowest termination point, and the doors will open. All the elevators, the doors will open, and the elevator lights will go out on the ones that are not fireman service, and the ones that you can use for fireman service, the lights will stay on. Now you'll take your key and go inside the elevator and put fireman service on inside the elevator car. Once you do that, you have captured that car. Now you can push the floor that you need to go to when the elevator will travel in that direction. If you push the cancel button at any time, the elevator will stop directly where it is, and you can change direction going down or continuing going up. When you get to your location that you're looking to get out, you have to push the door open button, which is actually a momentary button. I wouldn't call it momentary. It's a push and hold button because you have to hold that button in case you made a mistake. If you're not holding that button and you pull your finger off, the door will automatically shut. It's a safety feature that the fire service has put in because if you end up on the wrong floor, let's say they tell you the fire's on the 17th floor, so you travel to the 15th floor and the fire's actually on the 15th floor, when you open that door and the smoke starts to bellow in there, you'll pull your finger off, the door will automatically shut. When you do use fireman service, you have to be well aware that that door is completely open because if it's not and you walk out, that door will shut behind you and that elevator's out of service.
So when we talk about capturing the elevators as a catchphrase in the fire service, what we're saying is not only take possession, but maintain possession, assign an individual to the elevator. Try not to leave it empty.
Yes. In New York City, the way we do it is we assign a man just to work that elevator. He will shuttle people up and down throughout the whole event. We'll use the example of a fire on the 17th floor. He will shuttle people to the 15th floor. When the elevator is empty, he will bring the elevator back down and get the next company. And then he'll bring them up. And that's his sole job during the whole fire is to shuttle people from the lobby to the 15th floor so they can stage and get to the fire on the 17th floor.
And once again, looking at how labor-intensive many of the events we go to, when people look at a fire, a high-rise event from the outside and wonder why there are so many units assigned, you start to see the reality just with an elevator. One elevator, one person. Multiple elevators, multiple company members. So we can eat up resources quickly. Large municipal cities such as New York, L.A., Chicago, large volume of members on duty. You go to a smaller community, we're seeing now another taxing of our assigned resources or incident command and control knowledge needed to when to call for those additional helpers so we can fill all these key spots. With these, you know, a lot of changes have taken place in the elevators over the years. The elevator machinery room itself, we talked a little bit about just the difficulty of making access or how a hydraulic one would be on a lower level and a rope one would be on an upper level. The equipment in there, are these the types of equipment that a firefighter should attempt to engage, or what is our level of need when we're in one of these mechanical rooms? What should we be doing?
In the mechanical room, a firefighter's sole purpose in the mechanical room is to shut down the power and make sure it's not turned on. Because let's hypothetically say we're in a 10-story building and somebody on the 10th floor and wants to get down, but the elevators aren't working because we shut them down. He might not be beyond him to climb up to the elevator machinery room and see what's going on there, and he'll say, oh, the power's off, and turn it back on while you have people working in the shaft. So we want to leave someone there the whole time. And if we don't have the capabilities in some of the small departments, we have to use a lockout tagout system. One thing I'd like to touch on with the elevator machinery room is that when an elevator is moving up and down in a shaft, it's creating an airflow. And that air has to go someplace. So they have vent holes in the elevator machinery room. It's usually covered by a metal grate. And you can see all the way down the shaft. Sometimes those metal grates will be removed, and somebody may just throw a piece of linoleum or a carpet over the top of it. Guys have to be very aware when walking around an elevator machinery room that there's holes up there that you can step into and take the express right down to the pit. And it's not going to be a fun trip.
And, you know, and that falls right into those combination of tricks of the trade and job knowledge or functional knowledge of what to do. And the only way we learn anything is by sharing it with others. And I think this is key in the fire service as a whole to constantly be imparting the knowledge we've learned from others onto the next generation so that they can take it along and hand it off to others. You talked about turning it off and leaving it off. I think that's a key piece of information because we don't want to give a misconception that we're there as a repair service, where there is an emergency response service. So once it's shut down, it's doing a second activity of requiring a trained professional to be brought on scene to put it back into serviceability. I think part of it's liability. We live in that type of a society now. We have to be careful, but it's for the best protection of the citizens who will be using that area, that elevator after we leave. With these, you know, we talked about the various controls and that. Getting into an elevator, I know from my years in the fire service, sometimes has been our biggest nemesis. There's a lot of different types of doors just to begin with. We carry a large spool of various types of keys. Could you kind of give us some background, what types of doors actually are out there and how they work, and how do these keys come into play?
Well, there's at least six types of doors that I know of, between sliding doors and swinging doors and single sliding doors and bifold sliding doors. There's many different types of doors that you can find on an elevator. The keys are as varied as the doors, and it may be even more so because Acme makes one type of door, and then XYZ makes another type of door, and they're both the same type of door, but they're using different keys. So you end up with a large cache of elevator keys on your truck company. The idea is to get information to do this. I was taught by senior men in my department. When I was a 19 truck in the South Bronx, we did tons and tons of elevators. And how did I learn how to do it, and how did I become proficient? Because the old-timers taught me how to do it. And then eventually I started teaching the people younger than me how to do it. One of the best ways to learn how to do this is to get involved with the elevator mechanics in your local area and speak with them. They're more than happy to help, and especially to teach you how to do this and finesse it open, because if you break it, they have to get out of their house at midnight, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. They don't want to get up, unless they want the overtime, of course. But they really don't want to get out of bed to come fix an elevator. So these guys will be more than happy to teach you and get you the keys that you need to access these elevators and show you how to do it properly.
I think that's a great suggestion. You know, reach out to the people who are going to have the most knowledge. And in this case, it's the trained technician, the professionals who do it. And it's also, I think, good community relations. If we know more about their product, the more respectful of it we're going to be when we respond, and much greater chance of not doing needless damage.
Absolutely. I know that I've reached out to mechanics many times, and these mechanics would go as far as shutting down a bank for me so I can do drills, so I can capture an elevator, so we can simulate a person caught between a hoistway and an elevator, so we can get underneath and put blocks on it, so we can use our hoist to lift an elevator. These guys are more than willing to take you through and show you step by step how these things work. They really are quite cooperative.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to impart on our listeners, that, you know, reach out into your community, set something up, and it's excellent in-service training. Have them come out, do drills with you, help you establish your protocols, your standard operational guides, depending on what your department refers to your guidance as. The equipment you bring is probably different than what you bring to a working house fire. What type of equipment would you bring to an elevator call, and is there any benefits of how you package it or, you know, respond with it?
Well, one of the ways that we used to carry our elevator keys when I was a Boston 157 truck, we got a 4-inch piece of PVC, probably, I'd say, 18 to 24 inches, plugged one end, and then put a cleanout plug on the other end. And then we put a metal handle on it, and we just kept all our keys in there. So this way, we just unscrew the end cleanout plug and be able to dump our keys out and pick the keys that we need. It was unbreakable. It kept all of our keys in there, and it was always grabbable that you got all your keys at once, because you need them all in one spot.
And that's good. Anything you can do to basically pre-rig your response, whether it's in rope rescue or any of the other technical rescue fields, in this case, you're pre-rigging your specialized equipment for an elevator rescue. You know, when we get into the actual rescue itself, we've opened the doors. We've now identified the location of this elevator. Different types of removal, car-to-car, top hatch removal. We'll start with like a car-to-car removal of a victim. Kind of walk us through the sequence of, as a responding group, what we're going to need to do to get these victims safely out.
Okay, so let's hypothetically say we have a car stuck in a blind shaft. A blind shaft is a shaft that has no access except on particular floors. It'll travel many, many floors without having any access. So we have to take a rescue car, what we call the rescue car with the fireman, up to level with the stuck car where the victims are. Once we do that, we open up the side door with a key or force entry if we have to. We really don't want a force entry on that. We prefer to use a key because there is an interlock system and we have to get this rescue car to move again. Once we get the rescue car to where we need it, we open up the door and we shut the power. Then we will reach across and open up the door to the stuck car. Preferably, we put planks across from one car to the other, tie a member off with a life-saving rope, and put him into the stuck car. Now the member in the stuck car will determine the order of removal, tie off each individual, have them come across the shaft into the rescue car, then they'll pass the rope back to him, and that'll just go over and over until all the people are out of the car, out of the stuck car. Then the member will return to the rescue car. Once we close up the doors, we turn the power back on, one of the very few times we ever turn the power back on in an elevator, and the rescue car will take the victims out to another place where we can deposit them.
So by saying you're turning the power back on, that's in the car you were utilizing as part of your equipment per se. That was your traveling car, not the car with the original issue per se.
Correct. So that car's out of service. We turn the power off and leave it off. An elevator mechanic will determine what the problem is.
Okay. And these are the type of incidents, obviously, we don't mitigate instantly. These could be very time consuming.
Absolutely.
And this is one of those, similar to hazmat, it's better to go low and slow than to rush into it and make a mistake. You mentioned the rope. We're utilizing this both for firefighter safety, but you hit upon how important it is to safety the victims. They're already gone through one trauma. We would hate to create a second trauma in their life bringing them out.
You'd hate to drop somebody down a shaft.
Probably wouldn't look good on the following day's news headlines. Top hatches, a lot of times you don't even see them because there's a lot of aesthetic decorative materials, panels put in them. Do all cars have some type of a top hatch in it, or... Majority.
By New York City code, yes, they're supposed to. I can't say for the rest of the country, but by New York City code, we're supposed to have top hatches on everyone. Also, the top hatch in New York City also uses the interlock system. So once that hatch is open, you're cutting power to the car.
Okay. We read a lot coming from an urban environment too. We've heard a lot of car surfing, where young kids traditionally will get out of the car in one means or another and then go from car to car. So we're looking at some very unique hazard potential. Many codes will dictate whether these hatches could be secured or not, but we have heard stories of them being locked shut, tack welded shut. Have you run into anything or heard anything of that nature, you know, during your years responding to these type calls?
Absolutely. We had a rash of elevator surfing the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. The kids were just on top of the elevators, surfing the elevators, riding them up and down on the top of the car. And we lost several kids like that. You know, kids are kids. They do knucklehead things. And the kids would surf in the cars or jumping from one car to another as they were passing, and they miss and they fall down the shaft and get killed. On these elevators, they were actually spot welding the elevator top hatches shut, or screwing them shut, putting pieces of metal across there and screwing them shut so the kids couldn't get up there. And they were still, like, gaining access to the hoistway doors. You know, they're not dumb. They're very ingenuitive, but we have unfortunate incidents with children playing in elevators, sticking their arms into an open window on a hoistway door in the hallway. They stick their arm in and they'd lose a limb like that. We actually had an incident where a guy stuck his head through the window and lost his head, ended up with his head in the pit and his body on the 11th floor.
So definitely not positive outcome situations. You're talking counterbalances, heavy steel cars made to carry a large live load. So these are big pieces of equipment. When we have a situation, it is an emergency, the last resort type of situation, we don't have the key for the door, or there is no key opening. Not every door I've run into has that option or feature per se to them. What are some of the ways that you've utilized to gain access into the door, and when you do this, what are some of the methods that you've found most successful?
Well, Bob, when you're going to force entry on a door, you got to realize that this car is going to be out of service. You're going to have to get somebody to sit on it, a policeman or somebody's going to have to sit on this car, because you can't leave an open shaft. You just can't walk away from it. So once you force entry on this, you're ruining the car. You have to be careful if you have sliding doors and you're forcing entry not to drop the door into the shaft, because it's going to come off the track. On sliding doors, you force entry, you go high where the locking mechanisms are, so you don't cant the door and create a problem.
So just by using various tools, such as our airbags we would carry for a motor vehicle accident, where we position them is equally as important as what the bag itself is going to do, I take it.
Correct. If you put the bag on the bottom of the door where there's no locking mechanisms, you're going to end up canting the door and making your job that much more difficult. So if you bring the bag up high and get it as far in as you can, utilizing the pressure in the bag itself to pop the door, it'll just slide right open, and then you can access the elevator car door itself. You can do that with a rabbit tool, and in a rabbit tool, if you're doing the purchase, it only opens up so many inches, maybe about 10, 12, 14 inches. If that's not enough, you capture your purchase, you put an axe head or some other kind of wedge in there, and then you go and open it some more. You use the axe head or the wedge as a base for your rabbit tool so you can get a further throw on it.
Okay. And with these, if we can get an outer door open, there's always two layers of doors, the door on the floor of the structure we're in and then that inner door of the elevator itself. What are some of the methods that you utilize, you know, non-destructively to reach in to activate these different mechanisms?
Well, that's where it comes in knowing the elevators in your district. By going into the elevators and looking at how they work, you'll know how they work. It could be something as simple as depressing a roller, using a hook or a pike pole to reach across from one elevator car to another, and depressing a roller could open the doors. It could be grabbing a latch and pulling on it. It could be being on top of the elevator car and turning a wheel to open the elevator doors. It's just a matter of knowing the type of elevators in your district and becoming proficient with them.
Okay, good. Now we get to, you know, why we're normally called that rescue situation, but once we get there for a rescue call, we have to do more evaluation. We start looking at, is this a rescue or is this a recovery? How does that process impact the response and the individuals called to the scene?
Well, when we're talking recovery, there's no rush. If a person's dead, they're dead. They're not going to be more dead if we take 20 minutes. So we're just going to take our time and try and remove this person with dignity. If it's a person that's a viable life, we're going to do the best we can to keep them alive. But at the same time, we have to keep our people safe. We don't put our people into dangerous situations that's going to cost their lives. So by training and doing this over and over again, like I was saying earlier, I would go to the mechanics, they'd give me a bank, we train on how to take people out, whether a person's stuck between a hoistway and an elevator, they're stuck on top of an elevator, they've fallen into the pit. It doesn't make a difference which way it is. We practice this and practice this and practice this, so when the time comes to use this, we shine.
definitely hits the nail right on the head. Practice. We have to prepare for the calls we're going to be asked to respond to. This is a very high hazard, but an extremely low frequency type of an event. And many times our hours of dedication to this type of training go by the wayside. Do you see that happening in some of the different areas you've traveled through and people you've talked with?
Yes. What you said hits, is really key there. A low-frequency event requires a lot more training. A high-frequency event doesn't really require as much training because we're doing it all the time. So an elevator incident or an elevator rescue or recovery requires a lot of training because it's not something you do all the time. And you want to shine on something like this. When you walk away from an incident, in any fire department throughout the nation, throughout the world, I would imagine, when you walk away, people are going to say one of two things. They're going to say, wow, those guys are great. Call them if I'm ever in trouble. Or they're going to say, don't call those guys if I'm in trouble. You want to be the person that they say, I want those people to come and help me because they are obviously on their game. And that's why we train and that's why we practice.
Yeah, it's a real good point you make there. I mean, when we go, some of our calls will be recoveries. You brought up the point, you know, respect the dignity of the individual. This individual's family is already going to be suffering enough. What we do is another part of that positive image the fire service could push out to others. We have an unfortunate victim who has succumbed to their injuries, trapped between a elevator car and part of the structure or the shaft itself. These are large pieces of equipment. How do we move something like that without causing further damage, for lack of a better term, or creating an unsafe environment for our people?
Well, we have equipment to do that. They have what's called elevator rail clamps. You grab the elevator rail. They're hardened steel, and they actually grab onto the rail by wrenching them into place. And then you put large shackles on there, and on those shackles, you'll end up with large slings going across the crosshead, which is the top member of the elevator. You capture the crosshead with the slings, you capture the elevator rail with the elevator rail clamps, and then you put a come-along or a grip hoist in between. And this way, you're able to move the elevator fractions of an inch at a time to either remove a person or bring it up as high as you need to, so you can do this. It's all heavy-duty equipment or really good equipment. You don't go out and buy cheap equipment for something like this. We, New York City Fire Department has to use a lot of Crosby stuff. That's what they use because they know it's well-made. It has the tolerance to be lifting an elevator.
Lifting equipment coming into play there. What are some of the tools you use to lift it? Would you come in here with your traditional rope rescue equipment that we use for lifting, or is there specialized equipment you would use in this application?
I'm glad you mentioned that. You do not use Kern Mantle rope in something like this. The Kern Mantle rope is made for high-angle rescue, and yes, it has a 9,000-pound breaking strength, and it's got its safety margins, but you want to use 20,000-pound slings. You want to use a come-along that's able to lift 18, 20,000 pounds, a grip hoist that's able to lift 30, 40,000 pounds. You got shackles that are rated over 12,000 pounds. Your elevator rail clamps are rated over 12,000 pounds. You don't want to play around in this area because you may end up with three or four guys on an elevator just trying to recover this body, and doing it with dignity and lifting an elevator and supporting the body and trying to do everything at once. And if you have one weak link in there and this elevator falls, not only are you losing a body, but you're losing four firemen too. You have to have all your ducks in a row when you do something like this.
Great point. And there again, we're into heavy rigging. We're no longer lifting a one or two person live load or dead load as we would in rope rescue. We're now dealing with not only the human factor, but we're dealing with massive amounts of materials, steel and various other materials used to build these cars. So once again, just knowing those small parts of the big puzzle is going to make it a much safer and, positive operation for us. As we go through the different parts of this, one of the things I like to let our listeners know, coming in July at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland, Tony will be presenting a classroom segment on elevator emergencies. For those of you that are going to attend or anticipate attending, I would highly recommend sitting in on Tony's session. We've scratched the surface today, basically, on elevators, what's involved with them. But the biggest thing to remember from the beginning of our conversation today with the American with Disabilities Act, these are going to be in your community. You may come from a smaller rural environment, a suburban environment where you never really thought of it. now is the time to put a little thought into that and utilize, you know, your training hours for something you may go to. And as Tony hit on a number of times, reach out to your local professionals. Allow them to assist you and to develop your training. If you're lucky, they may have something in place that they can share with you. We don't always have to go out and create where we can share the knowledge from it. So we start to wrap up today. Tony, any closing thoughts and background on this specialty that you've spoken with us on today?
Well, as far as background goes, what I learned from guys who taught me. The senior men taught me, and I taught the junior men. I did do reading on this. I asked a lot of people how to do these things. I have no problem going over to an elevator mechanic and say, I don't know this. Please show me. And I learned a lot of stuff just by, I guess, you're a little bit humble and go out there and ask a lot of questions. And people taught me that.
And I think what you're doing for us today and what you do during your speaking engagements is you're sharing what you've had the luxury of getting with others. And I think that's one of the biggest responsibilities we all have in the fire service is passing it on, passing it along to the next individual who's going to sit in that front seat you previously occupied. So when they respond, not only are they safe, the crew they're responsible are safe, and then the community they're protecting has, you know, the full bang for their investment.
Absolutely.
You know, Tony, go ahead.
I was just going to say, train.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with that mindset. You know, I just want to thank you once again for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us today. Once again, look for Tony at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore this July. This is your host, Bob Dumel, for the Buzz and Technical Rescue. Thank you for listening today, and as always, be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.